6 minutes now past 11. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Minnesota's U.S. Senate race is turning out to be one of the most expensive in the nation, number three at last report, with still over 2 weeks to go before Election Day. Most of that money is being spent on TV ads, but the campaign has also been remarkable for the number of face-to-face debates. Last night, the candidates got together for what we believe to be the sixth debate so far, first one on TV. And there are still many, many more scheduled. Our next Senate debate here on Minnesota Public Radio is Monday noon. We'll be in Mankato at Bethany Lutheran College, and, of course, everybody's invited to attend. Now, we've also been inviting the candidates to come by our studios to talk with us one-on-one about their campaigns and to take your questions. And today, as part of our Meet the Candidates series, incumbent Republican Senator Rod Grams has joined us. And if you have a question for Senator Grams, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Senator Grams, thanks for coming by today.
Gary, my pleasure. It's always great to be able to stop by and to talk with you and your audience.
Pretty grueling schedule, plus you're supposed to be attending to Senate duties. I would imagine you're on life support at this point.
Well, it takes awfully long days. There isn't many minutes of a day that aren't accounted for between now and November 7th, whether it's here or in Washington, so it has been. But these are the way campaigns are. I said it's kind of like going to the dentist. You can't remember the pain of the last visit until you have to go through it again, and this is basically where we are. And it is a great demand, but there is, you know, so many things to do, so many places to go, and really the time is becoming limited. So every minute of the day is very important on what we do and try to get the message out and try to really compare, you know, my plans and policies and the things I have done with those that Mark Dayton says that he wants to do or try to do or whatever. So that's what's important, I think, to try to put some definition for the voters into these last couple of weeks of a very important campaign.
If you're reelected next month, would this be it then? Are you thinking maybe a third term, or what's your longer term plan?
I've always been a strong believer in term limits, and so I've said that this would be my last term if I'm lucky enough to be reelected by the voters of Minnesota. And I think it's I'm a strong believer in a citizen legislature, and those that work in the private sector go to serve and try to bring some of those common sense ideas and values to the Senate, common sense when it comes to voting, and then turn around and come back and again become part of the private sector and to live under the laws that you passed and help create and shape, because I think that's where the, you know, real proof of the pudding lies. So, growing up on a dairy farm and, all the working career I've had in private business, both as a small businessman and in other jobs in the media and others, that I think I bring a pretty good resume to the Senate as far as these common sense approaches. And but, yes, we'll serve just one more term if I'm lucky enough to be reelected.
One thing I've always wondered about, people in public life, on the one hand, wildly praised. People say you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Rod Grams we love Rod Grams. Then on the other hand, you've got people say, oh, Grams, he's a bum. What a bum. Worst person we've ever dealt with. How does that affect you personally, that these wild swings of publicly stated opinions about yourself?
Well, it does take its toll, Gary. I mean, you can say it doesn't bother you, but it does, because you go out there and you're basically, when I look at every piece of legislation that I'm asked to consider and vote on and every program that we're trying to work and help and shape or change or preserve or save, of course you're going to have some that agree with you and some that don't. And the approach you take to government is going to be wildly endorsed by one and, you know, again, not supported or favored by another. But I think you've just got to really keep the eye on the ball, so to speak, and the things that I've done and talked about in my campaigns, tried to remain real constant to those values. And I've said this many times, just like Senator Wellstone, you know, with Paul, what you see is what you get. And I hope that people can say the same about me, is, you know, what I've talked about, the votes I've taken, things what I've said in this campaign, back that up. So basically what you see is what you get. And I'm just hoping that there's more of those wildly enthusiastic supporters come November 7th.
Now, some of the critics have been complaining that you've spent more time, much more time, tearing down Mark Dayton than putting forward your own ideas, building up your own record. How do you plead?
Well, you know, Gary, in the debate last night, too, Mark Dayton says, well, we've both raised about $6.7 million in this campaign. And again, that's just a twist and distortion of the truth, because I've done this over a six-year period of time to raise $6.7 million to this point. Mark Dayton has spent that much. And by the way, he doesn't raise the money. He just writes it out of his checkbook. But he has done it now in about 3 months period of time. And over those 3 months, and collectively with other Democratic candidates that were in the primary race, and plus outside expenditures, really put about $15 million of negative campaigning against me. Basically saying things foolish as that Rod Grams doesn't like kids, or I don't like dogs and cats, that I don't like the elderly, I don't care about them, that somehow I vote against the environment, just like I don't drink water or I don't want to breathe clean air or my family. But, I mean, it's those type of distortions over the last 4 months that have been aimed against me. And what I've tried to do now with my campaign is try to set the record straight. It's not so much of the lies that Mark Dayton has told about me, but it's really the lies he has told about himself or the things he haven't said about himself or his programs. So I tried to, and really had to, try put some definition. Mark Dayton was not putting definition to his plans, like whether it was Social Security. He says there's nothing wrong with Social Security. In fact, we could expect surpluses, and we can go along as we are with no problems. But yet everybody, even last night in the debate, as Tim Russert brought up, the last flyer or the report from the Social Security Administration trustees says in 30 years, the system will only be able to pay 72% of current benefits. So the COLA we just read about in the newspaper today that's going to raise the Social Security retirement pay, this would actually mean a cut. There would be no COLAs. There would actually be a reduction in pay. And by the way, did you see it's $845? I don't know if that's the kind of average check that we want to leave for our children as far as a retirement when we can do better. So the negative ads have been blasted against me. And when I come back and try add a little definition to what these programs and plans are, whether it's his government-run health care, whether it's borrowing money from the trust funds to, you know, support a prescription drug plan, then all of a sudden I get labeled with being negative. And I think that Mark Dayton is the one who has been negative, distorting the record. And, Gary, before this race is over, I would assume at the clip that Mark Dayton is going at right now of spending money, he will have put about $20 million into this race when I think the final bill is tallied up. So, really, he is somebody right now who's willing to buy, say, or do anything and basically flip-flop on some of the issues now over the last couple of weeks. So this has become a debate also about Dayton versus Dayton, because he is changing some of his positions on taxes, on his health care proposal, on Social Security. And again, I think that is because he's putting a lot of money in the focus groups, and he is finding out that he needs to change some of the rhetoric to satisfy what the voters are thinking. And I don't want to govern with a finger in the air. I want to govern, I think, based on some sound policies, not sound bites.
In terms of the Social Security plan, of course, much of the debate is focused on your idea of privatizing a good share of the program. Any second thoughts now as the market stumbles along, goes in the tank here? Somebody was commenting the other day, yeah, right, boy, that'd be great to have my Social Security dependent upon that.
Well, they should stand back and look, because if you had put your money in there 4 years ago, it would almost be or more than doubled today. So that's not a bad investment. Sure, it has had a stumble this past week, but look at it over a 40-year term. And never in our history has a 20-year period of the markets ever been a decline. They've always been on the upswing. And over the last 75 years, the markets have paid better than 7.2% in real return after you wring out inflation and other things. So, no, the markets would be much better. And you compare that, by the way, Gary, over the last 15 years, Social Security has averaged less than 3.1% return on the money. Today it's down to less than 2%. And for someone out there that is 25 years old, they're going to have a negative rate of return. So the markets are still the best. Now, again, you know, your money doesn't have to be put into stocks. There are 1,000 financial instruments out there, including even a safe passbook savings account that would pay you more than 3 times what Social Security will pay you. So you can decide how you want to put your money to work for you, whether it's in stocks, whether it's in bonds, government securities, annuities, or even passbook savings. That can be your decision. So to say, well, just because the stock market is going down today, 3 months from now, it could be back over 11,000 again, and you'd be disappointed that you weren't in on that market climb. So I still think that overall, we have our best chance. And by the way, Gary, everybody, I think, has now agreed that investments have to be a part of the future of Social Security in order to save it. Somebody like Mark Dayton, who's basically never held a job, has no calluses on his hands, has lived and relied on investments for his livelihood or to increase his wealth. And at the same time, he's basically never paid into the system. So he really doesn't have the reality of that this is what I'm going to have to live on when I retire. So Mark Dayton might be willing to go out there and risk your retirement because his is safe, sound, and secure. Well, I've been there, I've done that, and I know what it's like to sit around a kitchen table and wonder how am I going to meet the bills this month. When my first daughter was born, I did not have health care. I had to find a way to make sure that we scrimped and saved and put money aside and went without to make sure our bills were paid. Mark Dayton has never had to face that kind of situation or that kind of crisis. So for him to talk about health care or to talk about Social Security without really having to face those realities, it's hard for me to say that I could trust his decisions.
Senator Rod Grams is our guest this hour, part of our Meet the Candidates series, and jot down the number. We have a full bank of callers here, so no point in calling right now. You'll just get frustrated. But try in a few minutes, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Tim, you're up first. Go ahead. Tim, you're on the air.
Senator, I believe that my wife and I are part of the 40% of married taxpayers who get a marriage bonus. I believe we pay less than if we were required to file as individual taxpayers. And does your proposal to eliminate the marriage penalty on those married taxpayers not in my 40%, will that have the effect of raising my taxes so I will no longer have an advantage over individual filers?
No, Tim, it would not. And again, it's the others that we're worried about, those who are facing the penalty. And it would not affect or change your taxes according to the codes as they are today. But at the same time, there are something like 30 million couples in the United States that are penalized because, or I'm sorry, it's 22 million couples, and it's a tune of about $30 billion that they pay in extra because the tax codes discriminate against them because they're married. They'd be better off or have less tax liability if they had the same income and remained single. So, no, this marriage tax penalty relief that we're talking about is trying to just adjust the codes to make sure that everybody is treated fairly and that some people, just because they choose to be married, are not going to have to pay more taxes because of that. And that's basically what the whole idea is about on the marriage penalty tax relief proposal. And I was talking to just a couple of last night, again, who brought this up to me, and how much they pay. It's well over $2,000 for this young couple, and they figured it out since, you know, this has been in the news a lot. So they very strongly support that. But no, Tim, this would not change your liability as far as reversing any kind of benefits you might have under the codes today.
As it is, though, as a Republican plan, Tim would also get a tax cut, too, in addition to those who actually pay an additional penalty, as it were, right?
Well, under our plan, it would equalize the rates so that those who right now have dual incomes would not pay the penalty. Now, Tim could also find some tax relief, but that might come in some other areas, and it could be under this plan, too. I don't know what his income situation would be, but it is something not to bring some down, but to help others out of this situation.
Jim, you're next.
Hi, this is Jim from Minneapolis. Thanks, Senator, for taking my call.
Yes, Jim.
In light of your concerns about saving Social Security, I'd like you to address my concerns of what to do with the current Social Security surplus, which results, in my opinion, from an overtaxation of the working poor. By the way, the federal income tax returns are still in deficit, if I recall. My question is, how to justify the Republican proposal to give tax breaks for income taxpayers using money generated by FICA overtaxation?
Okay, well, the current surplus is really broken down into a couple of areas, and one is that we know the surplus coming from the FICA taxes, and that is surpluses for Social Security and Medicare. And under the Graham's lockbox that I have introduced earlier in Congress, has been passed by Congress, would protect that. In other words, it would wall off those surpluses from any spending and any tax cuts in any way. It would be set aside for Social Security. On the other hand, though, there is about $1.83 trillion projected surplus over the next 10 years from income tax surpluses, and that's basically where most of the debate is over. And I have proposed that we take this surplus, first of all, make sure that we save Social Security and put those dollars from that surplus aside and keep it for Social Security, wall it off. The Graham's lockbox does that. But now on the income tax side, about the $1.8 trillion, I have proposed that we take about half of that to pay down on the debt, and that keeps us on a schedule to eliminate all public debt by the year 2012, so we don't pass on an immoral debt to our children or our grandchildren. And then to take the other $900 billion and to use that in a couple of ways. Set it aside for tax relief, but also monies that might be needed to help in the transition or the reform of Social Security and Medicare. Because those, to me, are all ways of getting these overcharged dollars, overcharged taxes, this again is tax surpluses, back to the working families, back to the taxpayer, either in the form of tax relief or helping to save and reform Medicare and Social Security. There are some out there that say, well, no, we don't want to do this. And if that money is left on the table and not given back to workers or taxpayers, even Chairman Alan Greenspan says it will be spent. He said, if history tells us anything, if there's a dollar left on the table in Washington, it will be spent. So we either got a choice here of getting money back into the hands of taxpayers and saving and securing Social Security and Medicare with the rest of this, or if it's left in the hands of people like Mark Dayton, who, by the way, has got more money spent than even a projected surplus provides, and from a fellow who doesn't even believe those surpluses will be there, he is spending, you know, like a reckless, with reckless abandon on this. But we need to make sure that we save this, because if it is spent to increase the size of government with new or expanded programs, the costs are going to go up, and Americans could actually, I believe, face a tax increase within the next few years in order to now support a larger and more expensive government.
This came up last night, but let me bring it up again. Would you be willing to tie your tax cut to a trigger mechanism? There is some question as to whether or not surpluses will actually develop over time here. Given the fact that once you cut tax, it's pretty tough to raise them again, would you be willing to tie any tax cut proposal to a trigger mechanism so that if those surpluses don't develop, you haven't given away money that doesn't exist?
Well, Gary, the myth is that it's easier to cut taxes than to raise them. And, in fact, we've only cut taxes twice in the last 20 years, but we've raised them about 10 times. Washington has had a tax increase package on the floor on average about every 22 months. So it's very easy for Congress to raise taxes. But, yes, I would set it to a trigger mechanism, and that's why I think it's so important not to build new debt or obligations built on a surplus projection. Because if that surplus doesn't materialize, how are we going to pay for those new expanded programs? Well, then they'll have to come and say, well, we have to raise taxes in order to do that. But yet if we say, all right, we're going to use these dollars to pay down the debt and then use what we can in the reform of Social Security and Medicare, if those dollars don't materialize, then we can't give back tax relief as far as the surplus goes. So I would be willing to tie it to that, because if the money isn't there, it would be awfully hard to give it back in tax relief. But if the money doesn't materialize and these new programs are set in place, it's like taking out a second mortgage on your home. All of a sudden, you're going to have to pay that second mortgage, even though the income you earmarked for that disappears. You're going to have to go somewhere to pay it. So, no, I'd be willing to do that, because right now we've got the surplus. It should go back in some form. And if it doesn't materialize, then we don't have the surplus.
Larry, your question, please.
Senator Grahams, I'm calling. I'm a very conservative voter, and one of the cornerstones of your campaign seems to be your commitment to the middle-class, traditional American family, and I hear that over and over, and I've gotten literature to that effect from your campaign. The thing I'm wondering is, given the state of your personal life and the situations with your family, how can I count on you to be my representative in Washington to represent my traditional family values?
Well, Larry, I think you can look at what I've done over the last 8 years while I've been in Congress, and that is in voting every time I can to try to provide relief when it comes to taxes for average working families, where I've tried to hold down the level of spending to make sure that we don't raise your taxes in the future. I've been working, and I come from a middle-class family. Like I mentioned, I grew up on a dairy farm. I've been there. I've done that. I've lived that and not far away from it. So my concerns are for average working Minnesotans, and everything I do and every vote I take in Congress is focused on that. We need a good, strong economy. We need a good, strong federal government, but we don't need a government that tries to do and say everything for us. So I'm going to continue on the same direction that I'm going, and that is continuing to assess every bill, every vote that I take, and is it going to be good for the country, and is it going to be good for families and taxpayers and workers? Is it going to be good for jobs? Is it going to be good for the environment? Those things. So I'm going to continue to work on that, and I think my votes and my record in Congress over the last 8 years have reflected that.
Joseph, your question, please.
Good morning, gentlemen, and good luck with your campaign, Senator.
Thank you, Joseph.
My question has to do with immigration and the alien residents and so forth, and they've opened over the next 3 years, 6,000 tech jobs. But I was wondering about the immigrants that may not have the advantage of getting that college degree and who still want to come over to the United States, where we have plenty, I believe, of probably illegal residents right now that are, you know, keeping our economy strong. And I'm wondering what his position is on that, where there, I believe there's some bill that is in process now about if they've been here illegal resident or illegal alien for 10 years that they'll be able to get their residency card.
Well, there is some talk about granting amnesty for illegal aliens, and I have not supported that because that basically means that all the people that came here under the law did what they needed to do to become legal citizens of the United States. We would just say, well, that's too bad, or you shouldn't have had to do that. We're going to grant amnesty to illegal aliens. But you're right, there are a greater number coming to the United States to work. We do have a worker shortage here and in many areas of jobs, and especially in the high-tech industry. And we have been trying to raise those B-1-2 visas to about 190,000 this year from an existing low that has been around 65,000. We had raised it a couple of years ago to about 115 or 110,000. But it just shows the number of workers that are being required in a lot of our high-tech industries, and not enough of these type of degrees coming out of our local colleges and universities. Many of these aliens are, have been educated in this country. They've been here and now have had to go back home. And so we've got an investment in them, but the need is here. And a lot of the high-tech industries will tell us that if we don't allow these workers to come into the United States to fill these positions, and by the way, they're not taking jobs away from Americans. If we could hire, if these businesses could hire out of our local universities and fill the demand they had, we wouldn't be facing this problem, but they can't. But they have told us that if they can't have these workers come in under these visas, that they'd evidently have to move a lot of their operations out of the country where they could have access to this labor pool. So this is very important that we do this and, you know, to look at it. But I would still, as you might have mentioned, Joseph, you know, we want to respect our immigration laws and to make sure that those who come here are legal and that we reward them in that fashion. But we also want people to come and immigrate to the United States, just like we're all a country of immigrants here. But when they're coming and wanting to work and be a contributing member of society. And so I have supported that.
Senator Rod Grams is our guest this hour, part of our Meet the Candidate series here on Midday. And again, if you have a question or comment for Senator Grams, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828, and we'll get to more of your calls in just a couple minutes.
If you thought this weekend's live broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion was sold out, think again. Beginning at 4:15 Saturday afternoon, all of the on-stage seating and the front row seats are sold in a $10 rush ticket line. Just show up at the Fitzgerald Theater box office in downtown St. Paul before 4:15 p.m. to get in line. Bring a friend and then sit back and enjoy the show. All $10 rush seats are cash only, and it's first come, first served. So you might want to get there early. Don't miss it.
Time now for news headlines. Here's Stephen Johns. Stephen?
Thank you, Gary. A retired Marine general says he takes full responsibility for the decision to refuel U.S. Navy ships in the Yemeni port where last week's bombing attack on the USS Cole took place. Anthony Zinni told senators today that the port was considered safer than others in the region. Meanwhile, the body of a 14th American sailor has been removed from the damaged destroyer. The search for the three remaining victims continues. With a ceasefire due to take effect by midday tomorrow, the violence hasn't stopped on the West Bank. Palestinians and Jewish settlers were firing at each other today on a hill overlooking the town of Nablus. One person died and nine were wounded. After yesterday's early sell-off, stocks are bouncing back on news of some leading technology companies' positive earnings reports. Microsoft is leading the way higher, helping lift the Dow back above 10,000 one day after the blue-chip index fell below that milestone for the first time since March. Northwest Airlines reported a 15% increase in third-quarter net income. Twin Cities-based Medtronic is buying a California company that makes a product which captures material dislodged during artery clearing procedures. Medtronic is paying $225 million in stock for Santa Rosa-based PercuSurge. Industry analysts say PercuSurge's technology will help Medtronic increase sales of its products. Medtronic is a leading manufacturer of pacemakers. Longtime Twin Cities activist Marv Davidoff will be the subject of a rally instead of the organizer of one. Fellow activists plan to honor Davidoff tonight with a benefit at the First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis. They hope to raise $15,000 to help Davidoff in his battle with prostate cancer and other ailments. Davidoff has been active in various social causes since the 1960s and is probably best known for his work on the Honeywell Project. Sunny, breezy, warm across the state today. Upper 70s to low 80s in the far south for the Twin Cities. A near record high around 80 today. It's 66 degrees now in the Twin Cities. And Gary, that's the latest from the newsroom.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. It's 27 minutes before noon, midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Republican Senator Rod Grams, who is up for re-election. And he has come by today to take your questions, talk about his campaign. Again, let me give you the number, but don't call right now. All of our lines are busy, but in a few minutes we'll clear some of those lines. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Senator, I need to ask you about a question that came up last night in the TV debate when you had a chance. Each of the candidates got to ask each other questions, and you asked Mark Dayton about the fact that he was proud of being on Richard Nixon's enemies list. What were you trying to get at?
Well, just exactly, you know, where this pride came from or exactly what he had done or said that the Nixon administration would, if it did, and I'm not sure, put him on this so-called enemies list. And all I could really get from him in his response last night was that he was opposed to the war, and he wrote a letter to the president saying he would not serve, and that was about the size of it. And he said it was some of the retaliatory action that was taken against him by the administration, maybe audits of his tax returns or whatever. And I don't know if those are real or, you know, if those actually happened. But I was just trying to find out exactly what in Mark's past had he done that put himself on the enemies list of a president of the United States that he was so proud of that he would want to put on his tombstone. Now, being against the war and a conscientious objector or going to teach school in New York City to avoid the draft, you know, that's one thing. But I wanted to really find out, and I didn't get an answer of exactly what he had done to get on that list.
Mm-hmm. Some people could read into that that you thought the idea of Richard Nixon keeping an enemies list was a good idea.
Well, no, I didn't, and I don't even know if there was such an enemies list.
Well, there was.
Well, and Mark Dayton, you know, was not a fan of Richard Nixon's anyway. I wanted to really just kind of find out what Mark had done to get on the list. But, no, was I a fan of that? No. If I was president of the United States, would I do that? No. I mean, in my office and my responsibilities as a U.S. senator, I never tried to find out or think to myself, who's my political friends and who's my political enemies when I'm looking at a vote or a policy or going into meetings with people. I go in there as open-minded and, you know, I never tried to take that in consideration. So would I support that? No, I'm not a fan of having any kind of an enemies list, and especially in politics, and for my job anyway, because once I'm elected, I represent 4.7 million Minnesotans, not just those who voted for me. And I have a responsibility to them as well, and to hear their concerns and to their views and to listen to them. And that's what I try to do. So, no, I wouldn't support an enemies list.
Were you suggesting that he's unpatriotic?
No, I wasn't doing that either. I mean, he's the one who has brought it up, and he has bragged about it, admitted, you know, that he went to teach Gould to avoid the draft, wrote a letter that said he would not serve if drafted, and whatever extent he would take to avoid that. So, no, I mean, he is the one who has brought this up and made an issue of it. I hadn't. But as long as he had brought it up, I was just trying to ask him, first, you know, why he was so proud of it, and second, what exactly was it that he had done besides, you know, making, you know, the contributions to the Black Panthers and avoiding the draft and going to New York City and writing letters to the president. I didn't know what else he had done. So that's what I was really trying to ask him.
Aaron, your question, please.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Earlier in the program, I heard Senator Graham, make a comment that he thought that Mark Dayton was actually running the negative tax on him.
Mm-hmm.
And just this morning, in my mail, I received a piece of direct mail from Senator Graham's campaign. It's a black, glossy flyer with a mugshot photo of Mark Dayton, and on the front it compared him to a Colombian drug dealer. And then it went in and talked about his, you know, $500,000 owning of medical stocks and all this. And I just wanted to hear Senator Graham's response to that, because I thought that was a very negative attack on Mark Dayton. And I thought it was almost horrific how it portrayed him on the front cover.
Well, Aaron, this is the way that Mark Dayton has portrayed himself, I believe, because it's the hypocrisy of what he has done and said. He's gone, and he is the one on record saying something to the effect that we worry about drug lords in Colombia, but the biggest drug lords, in fact, are those at the pharmaceutical company. So he is calling our pharmaceuticals drug lords in this country, saying, how can people profit at the expense of somebody's illness? But yet it was Mark Dayton who for years has held and profited from pharmaceutical stocks. So if the drug lords are the pharmaceutical companies and he is part of that, then he himself then is painting that picture, not me. Now he tried to, as he said, when he decided to take up a new hobby and run for the United States Senate. In fact, you know, he stopped an Arctic expedition, I guess, right in the middle of it, because it dawned on him that he was going to run for the Senate and come back. He decided that he was going to run for the U.S. Senate, so he did these focus groups and looked at, said, what are the biggest issues that I could use? And it came out, well, maybe prescription drugs and energy. So he immediately went and dumped all those stocks, trying to basically cleanse himself and then be hypocritical to go out now and attack the very stocks that he for years has owned and profited by. So that's what I'm trying to point out in this flyer, that here is a man who says something but has done another. So how can you trust him on what he is saying? Is he doing it for his own advantage, or is there a real concern there? I would say it's more aimed at Mark Dayton's advantage in trying to win, buy, or say anything to win a political race.
Ali, your question?
Thank you very much, Gary, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Graham, I have a couple of quick questions. I'll be very brief.
Yes, Ali.
First of all, I don't consider myself a Republican or Democrat, but when it comes to voting, I'm a conservative voter.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have a problem. I wanted to ask you where you stand on the issue of repealing the Secret Evidence Act, which targets primarily Muslim Americans or Arab Americans, which, by the way, you know, I was very delighted to hear that Governor Bush on the second presidential debate said he would support it, which is led by now in the Senate, Senator Spencer Abraham. Am I right, Senator?
Yes. What is the act again?
It's a Secret Evidence Act, which, okay, you know, holds people in jail without any evidence and without telling people why they are holding all those people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's led by the fight is led by Senator Spencer Abraham,
sure,
in the United States Senate to repeal that, which targets only Muslim Americans and Arab Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ollie, I have to say I'm not real familiar with that, but I am very familiar with Spencer Abraham, and as you know, he's from Lebanese descendants, and he is very strong on these issues and a very good watchdog of those, and I would not support that type of activity. If there is secret evidence that are being held and mainly targeted against one group, you know, of course, I would not support that, so I will take a look at that, but I would agree with you, but again, I'll talk to Spence more in detail about this and exactly what the act is and what we can try to accomplish through the legislation, as you've mentioned, that he has supported or introduced.
Foreign policy question. You've been involved in overseeing UN activities and
mm-hmm.
the rest. This question came up the other day. We were doing a show on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and a couple of callers actually raised the issue, wondering why it is that the United States seems to be the only country in the world that always opposes resolutions that criticize the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
Are we out to lunch on this, or is the rest of the world out to lunch, or what's the deal?
Well, no, in the last resolution that was written was basically trying to blame Israel for all the violence that is currently going on right now in Israel, that somehow it was only the fault of the Israelis or the Israeli government and nobody else was to blame. And even Richard Holbrooke, our ambassador to the UN, said that it was very poorly crafted and very one-sided. And if it's going to be a one-sided resolution that only singles out one group, there's enough blame of the problems going on in Israel to go around. And that's what that resolution basically did. So are we concerned with the violence from both sides? Yes, we are. But to try say that it's only one side that's responsible, and I thought was a, like, and I agree with UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, that it was a poorly crafted, one-sided type of resolution.
Why
and the United States really, I think in many quarters here in this country, were criticized for not vetoing it, just standing by. And I think they should have vetoed it because of the way it was worded. Not that I blame just the Palestinians for the violence and not the Israelis, but the fact that it was such a poorly crafted, one-sided prejudice type of an amendment, the United States should have just said, this will not be tolerated and vetoed it.
Mm-hmm. Why are all these other countries so eager to pass these kinds of resolutions?
I'm not sure, and I understand that the UN might be considering even another resolution yet today as we speak, dealing with similar type of language. If that happens, of course, there will be another vote, and either the United States is going to stand up and veto it or maybe go in abstention on it. But I can't understand that either. But Israel, as you know, is not allowed to sit on any of the committees in the UN. So basically, it's a country without a seat in the United Nations. And this is, I think, another attitude toward Israel by, the UN. And I've worked very hard to try and make sure that Israel can become part of one group. They have the body is broken up into a number of groups, and we've tried to make sure that Israel gets a seat or a voice in one of those groups. Right now, it does not have that.
Jim, your question, please.
Yes, Senator Graham. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
I am curious, listening to your talk this morning, in your claim to be representing and listening to your constituents in Minnesota, how you could be doing this and have earned a zero voting record on labor issues. Are none of your constituents, do you feel, in Minnesota working class people, or how do you obtain that status and claim that you're listening to your constituents?
Well, I think I've been a good friend to workers, and I've been a member of the unions myself, and I come from a working class family, so to say that somehow I'm not concerned about jobs and good jobs and union jobs is not right. But it's, of course, some of the ways they have their scorecards. Now, they don't support free trade. I do. I've been endorsed by the timber industry up in northern Minnesota. So there are many areas. And I think that a good, strong, healthy economy with great trade opportunities, and we need good, healthy companies in order to provide good jobs. So I always try to look at this as a way that how are we going to provide economic growth that's going to provide our companies with the jobs that are going to be offered to workers at good pay with good benefits. And that's what I base my criteria on. And a lot of this, I know some of these ratings, and, these ratings, these scorecards, those that are in my favor and against me, a lot of these just take certain votes, and they score them on maybe just 10 out of the 2,000 votes I've cast or 3,000 votes I've cast in the Senate over the 6 years I've been there. So I think you'd have to sit down with me and look at every vote and why I took the vote. But I'm not against labor. I strongly support working Americans, and I will continue to do that. And not only trying to help them, get good jobs and create an environment, basically, for that to happen, but also to work to make sure that their take-home pay is protected from, gross over-taxation that we have in this country today. So I consider myself to be a great friend of workers in Minnesota.
We hear a fair amount about living wage, the living wage. Should the government have any role in trying to make sure that people get paid whatever gets defined as a living wage?
Well, there again, Gary, who is going to define it? We have, Mark Dayton is out there saying that it should be between $9 and $12 an hour. So not only does he want to impose mandatory health care, government-run health care, on businesses, but now he wants to impose price controls when it comes to wages. The free market doesn't work that way, and what it would end up doing is costing a lot of jobs, and a lot of these jobs are entry-level jobs for our young people. The first time they get a chance to go to work, to begin that training, to give them the experience that they need to move up that ladder for better and better jobs. But if you cut them off, if an employer can only afford to pay $7 an hour for this job, and you say, no, you got to pay $9, well, that job won't be there, so somebody is going to miss out on that. And again, these are mainly entry-level jobs, and I don't agree that there can be that type of price control. We want to make sure everybody has got a good living and that they can make good money, and a lot of that comes with job training, good education, but also good opportunities, and those jobs have to be out there, and that comes from having a good, healthy, expanding economy with good trade opportunities that's going to make these jobs available. So coming on the back end and trying to set price controls or wage controls does not solve a problem. Is the job going to be there at all? And so I'm looking, at trying to provide or vote for legislation that's going to enable our economy to continue to grow and offer these jobs.
Do you see what's sometimes referred to as a concentration of wealth being a problem, the fact that there are relatively small number of people with a huge amount of money in this country, and then there's everybody else?
Well, I don't know if it's up to the government to pick winners and losers and to say they're going to take from some to give to others. So again, I'll go back to Mark Dayton, and in his own statements, he thinks our tax system should be a way of redistribution of wealth. He thinks that the national economy should be there to create the wealth and then equally distribute it. Now, again, that's, you're talking about what has been tried in Russia and other countries like that, and it has failed. So, the concentration of wealth, I'm not out there trying to defend the super rich of this country. But also, we've got to look at what is capital formation. Where is going to be the investments that are going to create the economy that's going to produce these jobs? The money has got to be there, and it's going to come from someone. But I'm not trying to put into any kind of a position a tax code or policies that is going to favor one group over the other. But I want to make sure that the opportunity to invest is there, that the opportunity for the economy to grow is there, and the opportunity to make a profit and to make a living, whether you're a working man or an investor or whatever, that the economy is going to be good to all of us. The old saying that, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I'm hoping that as the economy grows and expands, everybody is going to benefit from that on the economic ladder.
Kevin, your question, please.
On that same theme, former Justice Louis Brandeis was quoted as saying, you cannot simultaneously have a very large disparity in wealth and simultaneously maintain democracy. And Mr. Grams, I've been disappointed in your stand over the years against campaign finance reform. And you've repeatedly cited Buckley versus Valeo as an obstacle to campaign finance reform, but you don't try to work on it anyway. But since Buckley versus Valeo, within the last year, there have been other court cases, at least one out of the state of Missouri, stating that they may support campaign finance reform. Have you changed your position on that issue? Take my answer off the air. Thank you.
No, when it comes to campaign finance reform, everybody. A lot of the arguments, the McCain-Feingold bill, is basically trying to put new limits on people's abilities to be involved in campaigns, and that's basically an infringement on First Amendment rights, and that's what the Supreme Court has upheld time after time, that these campaign finance laws that have been written or proposed are unconstitutional and have been struck down. Now, when you talk about campaign finance reform, if you're going to limit a candidate's ability to raise money, to go out and get their message out, you're going to leave it into the hands of the super wealthy, like Mark Dayton, who's going to be spending, I would assume, up to $20 million to buy this race. So you're going to limit it to those who are wealthy enough to buy an election, or you're going to put it into the hands of others, like the media, or the newspapers, the editorial boards, because they will have a louder voice than will the candidates. Now, if you look at my race, I have gotten some contributions from 47,000 Minnesotans. and those campaigns average less than $50 apiece. About only 25 or 26% of my money has come from other contributions than individual Minnesotans, 47,000. Now, Mark Dayton, on the other hand, has only got a handful, and the major source of his money has been his own wealth. So when you're talking about campaign finance reform, but yet you're willing to turn away from what Mark Dayton is being able to do or spend his own money, and yet criticize us who want to make sure that this system is open and that everybody can be involved in it, whether it's through small contributions or not, but it's a First Amendment right to be able to be a participant in a campaign. And when people talk about campaigns having too much money, we spend more money in this country every year per person to support the United Nations, for instance, than we do to support our own electoral system. So I think we've got the best government in the world, and we spend less on that than we do on the United Nations. So do we need some campaign finance reform? I would say in the order of making sure we have full disclosure on who's contributing to who is spending money on what ads, and rather than putting more limits and restraints on people wanting to have the opportunity to get involved in an election.
Mark Dayton has made the argument that because he's not accepting contributions, essentially, from anybody, he's going to be his own man.
Well,
and he doesn't really have to kowtow to people and give them special access and the rest.
Yeah, well, he would give nobody access because basically if you're beholden to nobody, you're accountable to nobody. And we've been trying to get Mark Dayton to come out and tell us what is his plans for Social Security, what is his plans for health care. He has basically said now, you'll hear the details of my health care bill when I'm able to unfold them on the floor of the U.S. Senate. So in other words, elect me and trust me that I'm not going to shove a government-run down system down your throat, but I'm not going to tell you exactly anything about that. Mark Dayton is trying to hide behind slick sound bites, slick commercials, and not coming out with details. Because I think if people realize exactly the plans that Mark Dayton is proposing, that it is nothing more than larger government, and he's going to have the government being more control, and that, of course, means more spending. And for the workers out there, that means it's going to take more taxes. So Mark Dayton puts his trusts in government, and I put my trust in individuals. And I think it reflected just in the campaigns themselves. 47,000 contributors compared to one. So Mark Dayton, when you talk about, you know, beholding to somebody, I would ask, who is he going to be accountable to? I would basically say he can go to Washington and listen to Mark Dayton and not open the doors to listen to Minnesotans.
Senator, some predictions indicate a record low voter turnout. It's kind of generally been going down anyway, but some of the pundits say that this could be even lower than normal. Is that what you're sensing out there on the hustings?
No, in Minnesota, you know, has always had a better turnout. Nationally, it might be a lower turnout, but Minnesotans have always been willing to go to the polls and have their voices heard. And we expect to have a large turnout in Minnesota this year. And we've got some great races. George W. Bush, I believe, is going to win the race here in Minnesota for president, put Minnesota for the second time in the last 50 years in the Republican column, and I think that would be a great win. And so I'm working toward that as well. But no, I think Minnesotans are, I think we get our numbers in our forecast, we expect a large turnout in Minnesota style and tradition.
Senator, thanks for coming in today. Good luck to you.
Gary, thanks so much. It's always nice to be here and talk with you.
Republican Senator Rod Graham's joining us as part of our Meet the Candidate series. We'll be rebroadcasting this program at 9 tonight. Also, check out our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, for lots more on the candidates and the campaigns. Monday in Mankato, another U.S. Senate debate. Join us at Bethany Lutheran College at noon. And then a reminder tonight over at the College of St. Catherine, O'Shaughnessy Auditorium, we'll be moderating a debate with the 4th District candidates.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week on The Splendid Table, trendsetter Faith Popcorn joins us with an inside look at how food is marketed to women. We'll also be talking about cider and Oktoberfest, and we'll have some surprising information about sulfites in wine. That's The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat, Saturday at 1 and Sunday at 6 a.m. on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1.
5 minutes now before 12 o'clock.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 19th of October, 2000. It's the anniversary of the surrender of the British General Cornwallis to George Washington's troops at Yorktown, 1781, the effective end of the American Revolutionary War. The British had been under a bombardment by the French fleet for 3 weeks in their fort when Washington and 17,000 men circled the fort. On the 17th, Cornwallis waved a white flag from the fort wall, and on the 19th, he surrendered as his band played an old British tune, "The World Turned Upside Down," the words to which were, "If ponies rode men and grass ate cows and cats were chased into holes by the mouse, if summer were spring and the other way round, then all the world would be upside down." It was on this day in 1849 Elizabeth Blackwell became the first woman in the United States to receive a medical degree. She had applied to medical colleges all over the country, was rejected by all of them but one, Geneva College Medical School in New York State. After graduation, she had to move to Paris to find work and then London, where she trained at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. She came back to New York City. She was 31 years old, set up a practice, and the following year, 1857, she opened the New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children. And it's the birthday of the spy novelist John Le Carré, born David Cornwell in Poole, England, 1931. Author of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and other spy novels starring the British intelligence agent George Smiley. Here's a poem for today by C.S. Lewis entitled "The Day with a White Mark." All day I have been tossed and whirled in a preposterous happiness. Was it an elf in the blood or a bird in the brain? Or even part of the cloudily crested 50-league-long, loud, uplifted wave of a journeying angel's transit roaring over and through my heart. My garden's spoiled, my holidays are cancelled, the omens harden, the planned and unplanned miseries deepen, the knots draw tight, reason kept telling me all day my mood was out of season. It was, too, in the dark ahead, the breakers only are white. Yet I could have kissed the very scullery taps. The color of my day was like a peacock's chest. In at each sense there stole ripplings and dewy sprinkles of delight that with them drew fine threads of memory through the vibrant thickness of the soul, as though there were transparent earths and luminous trees should grow there, and shining roots worked visibly far down below one's feet. So everything, the tick of the clock, the cock crowing in the yard, probing my soil, woke diverse buried hearts of mine to beat, recalling either adolescent heights and the inaccessible longings and ice-sharp joys that shook my body and turned me pale, or humbler pleasures, chuckling, as it were, in the ear, mumbling of glee as kindly animals talk in a children's tale. Who knows if ever it will come again, now the day closes. No one can give me or take away that key. All depends on the elf, the bird, or the angel. I doubt if the angel himself is free to choose when sudden heaven in man begins or ends. A poem by C.S. Lewis, "The Day with a White Mark," from his Poems, published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.